What if the Caribbean wasn't a departure from Africa, but a secret return? What if every drumbeat, every word of patois, every carnival feather and freedom chant was not just island culture, but ancestral memory fighting to be heard? This is not fiction. This is the hidden truth buried in our food, our gods, our rebellions, our skin. The Caribbean is not what they told us. It's what we're remembering. From slave ships to sound systems, from spirit altars to reggae stages, this is the story of how African soul survived captivity, shaped nations, and transformed exile into identity. This is Caribbean history, the hidden connections between Caribbean and African cultures. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Echoes across the Atlantic. The wind carries more than salt when it moves over the Caribbean Sea. Beneath the surface of turquoise waters lies a silence filled with memory, fragments of languages, customs, and rhythms once carried by human cargo, now reborn in spirit. To understand the Caribbean, one must listen not only to its steel drums and patois, but to a deeper resonance, an African heartbeat that never stopped echoing. Centuries before reggae danced into the world's consciousness, or the Maroons carved their names into the mountains of Jamaica, Africa had already whispered itself into the soul of the Caribbean. From the Sahel to the Gold Coast, from the Bight of Benin to the banks of the Congo River, kingdoms rose and cultures flourished, until the Atlantic slave trade began carving Africa's sons and daughters from their homeland. Ships bound for the Americas were not empty vessels of labor. They were archives, floating vessels of culture, belief, resistance, and soul. Each enslaved African who disembarked in Barbados, Trinidad, Haiti, or Jamaica brought more than a body. They brought drum languages, agricultural wisdom, medicinal knowledge, spiritual systems, and memory. These were not erased, they were translated. In Haiti, Vodou took shape, not as superstition, but as a system of cosmological resistance born from the Fon, Yu, and Yoruba faiths. In Jamaica, Kumina preserved Bantu rhythms and ritual practices that defied plantation Christianity. In Trinidad, the Orisha traditions survived behind Catholic iconography, cloaking their gods and saints, but never abandoning their names. But culture is not merely survival, it's transformation. When the enslaved looked at their oppressor's language and twisted it into Creole, they were creating. When they took broken instruments and invented calypso, they weren't just singing, they were reclaiming power. The drum did not die, it changed form. The masquerades of West Africa became Jankunu and Carnival. The griots of Senegal found new life in the Calypsonians and dub poets of Port of Spain and Kingston. Beyond music and religion, food too became a fusion of survival and memory. Okra, yams, callaloo, these were not just meals but edible ancestry. In the open-air markets of Accra and the food stalls of St. Lucia, one finds not a coincidence but a continuation. Cassava bread in Suriname is the echo of a knowledge system that predates colonial borders. And yet, these connections were not always celebrated. Colonial education told Caribbean children that Africa was savage and uncivilized. The whip erased names. The church silenced songs. African identity was not lost, it was buried. But like buried seeds, it bloomed in secret. During nighttime drumming ceremonies, within whispered proverbs, or in the movements of a ritual dance, Africa survived, even flourished. In recent decades, a new awakening has emerged. Caribbean scholars, musicians, spiritual leaders, and activists are reconnecting with ancestral roots, not as a distant curiosity, but as a living bloodline. Pan-Africanism wasn't just a political ideology, it was an emotional and spiritual homecoming. Marcus Garvey understood this. So did Kwame Ture. So did the people in the ghettos of Kingston and the banlieues of Paris, who saw Africa not as backward, but as the beginning. The truth is this, the Caribbean is not a break from Africa. It is an extension, a branch twisted by trauma, but rooted in power. The connections are not hidden, they were made to be forgotten. But memory, like water, finds its way through stone. This is just the beginning. In the chapters that follow, we'll explore the spiritual blueprints, musical DNA, linguistic hybrids, resistance movements, and artistic rebirths that reveal how African culture didn't just survive the Middle Passage. It transformed the Caribbean into a beacon of cultural resistance and global influence. And so, as we walk through time, remember, Every beat, every word, every gesture in the Caribbean carries within it a whisper from across the Atlantic. A whisper that says, "We are still here." Gods in Disguise: How African Spiritual Systems Shaped the Caribbean Soul. It often begins in shadows, at dusk, in the stillness of cane fields, behind closed doors where incense burns and drums murmur like ancestral breath. The Caribbean has always been a place of many gods, but not all wore the names given by colonizers. Beneath the cross hung over plantation chapels, beneath the Latin of Catholic Mass, something older stirred. Africa had not left her children without guidance. Her spirits had crossed the ocean too. When enslaved Africans arrived in the Caribbean, they brought with them cosmologies that were as complex as any cathedral. Yoruba Orishas, Congo spirits, Dahomeyan Vodun, Akanabuzum. These were not just gods, but systems of balance, justice, memory, and healing. They did not vanish under the lash of European Christianity. They evolved, adapted, survived. In Haiti, the land of fire and freedom, the fusion birthed Vodou. Misunderstood and demonized by outsiders, Vodou was never witchcraft, it was resistance in ritual form. Its Lwa, spirits like Legba, Ezeli, and Ogoun, offered more than magic. They offered protection, power, and a sense of cosmic order to a people denied earthly justice. A child might be baptized Catholic, but at night, the family altar told a different story. Candles lit for saints doubled as beacons for spirits whose names still echoed in Fon and U dialects. In Cuba and Trinidad, the Yoruba pantheon took new forms in Santeria and Shango baptism. Catholic saints became camouflage. Chango as Saint Barbara, Yamaya as Our Lady of Regla. This was not syncretism out of surrender. It was strategy. Hiding gods in plain sight was a masterstroke of cultural rebellion. To preserve the sacred, the enslaved became spiritual shapeshifters. In Jamaica, Kumina ceremonies kept the Congo flame alive. Possession, drumming, and spiritual invocation weren't mere theatrics. They were acts of survival, of reconnection to a metaphysical homeland. When enslaved people danced until trance, it was more than faith. It was memory reclaiming the body. Even the Rastafari movement, often framed only in political or musical terms, carries spiritual echoes. Its reverence for Haile Selassie, its Ital dietary laws, its use of herb as sacrament, and its deep suspicion of Babylon, a code for Western imperialism, are layered with African spiritual logic. It is no coincidence that Rastas chant Naya Bingi, named for an East African queen who led anti-colonial revolts. The divine feminine, the warrior spirit, the ancestral right, they all live on. These systems were never uniform. No two islands followed the same ritual path. But the patterns are undeniable. In every island where African descendants landed, the gods adapted to new soil. Caribbean spirituality is not merely Christian with a twist. It is a hybrid flame, African in origin, Caribbean in context, global in consequence. To outsiders, it looked like superstition. To the enslaved, it was salvation. When the colonizers outlawed drumming, it was because they feared what it summoned: unity, rebellion, identity. They knew that in the deep hum of the talking drum lay instructions. Coded messages passed between plantations, prayers laced with warning, signals of uprisings to come. And still, the rituals survived. Today, as Caribbean descendants reclaim ancestral traditions long demonized by colonizers and missionaries, a new language of pride emerges. Ritual is no longer shameful. Ceremonies once hidden in backyards now fill cultural centers and open-air festivals. Scholars trace symbols once dismissed as folklore back to their African roots. Drummers no longer whisper, they thunder. The gods were never gone. They were only waiting to be remembered. Language of the Dispossessed: How African tongues birthed Caribbean voices. Words are not neutral. They carry the weight of history, trauma, and transformation. For the enslaved Africans torn from dozens of language groups, Igbo, Yoruba, Wolof, Kikongo, Akan, Mandinka, language was the first battlefield. Stripped of the right to speak their mother tongues, they were forced to learn the languages of their captors. But the Caribbean would not become a graveyard for African speech. Instead, it became a crucible where a new way of speaking was forged, born of rebellion, necessity, and genius. Creole, Patois, broken English, call it what you will, these were not corrupted languages. They were linguistic revolutions. On the plantations, African people were often intentionally mixed by slavers to prevent organized resistance. Different tribes, different tongues. But what the colonizers didn't expect was how quickly the enslaved would build new bridges between their fragmented languages. What emerged was not silence, but a code. Caribbean Creoles took the vocabulary of the colonizer and bent it to African rhythm, syntax, and worldview. The sentence structures, the tonal inflections, the metaphors, they bore African DNA. In Haiti, Creole became the first Creole language to gain national status. Rooted in French vocabulary, but fiercely African in its syntax and cadence, it allowed the enslaved to communicate under the watchful eyes of overseers, and later to organize the only successful slave revolt in the Western Hemisphere. Language became weapon, strategy, and identity. In Jamaica, Patois became more than slang, it became poetry. When Louise Bennett Coverley, affectionately known as Miss Lou, stood on stages reciting verses in Jamaican dialect, she wasn't just performing. She was validating a culture long ridiculed as inferior. She was teaching Jamaicans to see beauty in their own voice. The evolution of these hybrid tongues was not accidental. They carried hidden grammars of survival. For example, in many Caribbean dialects, time is fluid, echoing African languages that use aspect rather than tense. The use of repetition for emphasis, call and response structures, the rhythm of speech, all trace back to African oral traditions where the spoken word is sacred. Even in music, language evolves with purpose. From calypso to reggae to dancehall, the voice becomes drum. Lyrics twist and slide, often layered with double meanings and political critique masked in metaphor. The griot tradition lives on, not in the palaces of Mali, but in the lyrical battles of sound systems and carnival stages. But the journey of Caribbean languages hasn't been easy. For generations, speaking Creole or Patois was punished in schools, deemed uncivilized or uneducated. Children were taught to be ashamed of how their grandparents spoke. English, French, Spanish, these were the languages of success, of power. But even as tongues were disciplined, hearts remembered. In the last few decades, this tide has turned. Linguists, poets, and educators have reclaimed Creole as not just a tool of communication, but as a pillar of national identity. In St. Lucia, Dominica, Martinique, Guadeloupe, and beyond, Creole festivals celebrate the vibrancy of a language once whispered in kitchens and shouted in cane fields. Music, film, and literature now elevate these dialects into mainstream expressions of pride. Language, in the Caribbean, is a site of resistance. It is where trauma and creativity coexist. Every phrase is layered with history, some painful, some defiant, all deeply human. Because in the end, the tongues of Africa did not vanish in the Atlantic. They morphed, merged, and manifested. They live on in every Patois prayer, every Calypso chorus, every lullaby sung in a backyard somewhere in Port-au-Prince, Castries, or Kingston. The dispossessed did not lose their voice. They created a new one. Rhythm of resistance, how African music became the pulse of the Caribbean. Before there were revolts, there were rhythms. Long before a machete was raised or a proclamation of freedom made, the enslaved carried rebellion in their wrists and throats. In the call of the drum, the echo of the chant, the defiant sway of hips unbroken by chains. In the Caribbean, African music didn't just survive. It transformed into a coded language of resistance and identity. Every beat, every note, every silence between notes meant something. The Atlantic didn't drown the drum. It only deepened its echo. In West Africa, music was never separate from life. Drumming signaled birth, death, harvest, war. The talking drum conveyed sentences, the balafon and kora told ancestral stories. When these instruments were banned on plantations, deemed dangerous because they connected people, the enslaved found new ways. They used their bodies. They slapped rhythms into wooden floors, clapped codes into their palms, turned the very air around them into a conspirator. This cultural reinvention gave birth to some of the most iconic sounds on earth. In Trinidad and Tobago, the twin legacies of African percussion and colonial repression collided spectacularly during Carnival. When the colonizers banned drumming, enslaved Africans took to using bamboo sticks and tins. Out of that defiance, the steel pan was born. Today, the steel drum is synonymous with the Caribbean, but its roots lie in rebellion, music forged in protest. Calypso emerged as another voice of the people. With its sharp wit and layered metaphor, it was the griot's blade, cutting through colonial lies with satire and rhythm. In the baroque yards and masquerade tents, calypsonians became both reporters and prophets, mocking the British, elevating the people, and daring to speak what others feared to say. In Jamaica, Kumina and revival drums laid the foundation for a musical evolution that would shape the world. Out of mento came ska, from ska came rocksteady, and from that, reggae. More than a genre, reggae became a global voice for the oppressed. Its heartbeat rhythm, the one drop, was rooted in Nyabingi drumming, the spiritual rhythm of Rastafari rituals that echo the Congo's pulse. Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Burning Spear didn't just make music. They preached sermons of cultural memory, calling home the diaspora with every verse. Old Pirates, Yes They Rob I, was not just lyric, it was indictment. Africa Unite was not idealism, it was instruction. And as reggae moved through the world, so did its message. The African continent heard the Caribbean calling and called back. Afrobeat in Nigeria, Zouk in the French Antilles, Soukous in Congo, all of it, in some way, bears Caribbean fingerprints. Today, artists from Lagos to London sample dancehall, trap into rhythms, and remix ancestral spirits into club anthems. Music is where the African-Caribbean connection dances loudest. And not only in protest. It's in joy, in resistance celebrations, in weddings, in funerals, in roadside cookouts and resistance marches. The sound systems of Jamaica, the carnival trucks of Trinidad, the rara bands of Haiti, they're all declarations. We are still here. And we're still singing. Music in the Caribbean is not entertainment alone. It is archive. It is protest. It is testimony. It is healing. The colonizers came with chains. The Africans answered with rhythm. And that rhythm has never stopped. Warriors without uniforms, African fighting traditions, and Caribbean revolts. The Caribbean is often romanticized for its beaches, its music, its spirit, but buried beneath the sand are bloodlines of rebellion. These islands are not simply tropical paradises. They are battlegrounds, scarred with the footsteps of warriors, many of whom were never recognized in official histories. They didn't wear medals. They weren't trained in academies. But they carried with them something older, deeper, the fighting wisdom of Africa. When Africans were captured and shipped across the Atlantic, the chains they wore did not erase the knowledge stored in their bones. Among the enslaved were military captains, warriors, archers, strategists. Men and women who had fought in the Ashanti, Dahomey, or Congo wars now found themselves in plantations instead of battlefields. But war, like memory, doesn't die easily. They adapted their combat into new forms of resistance. Guerrilla warfare, coded communication, herbal medicine, ritual protection. These were the hidden arsenals of Caribbean revolution. The Maroons of Jamaica are a prime example. Escaped Africans fled into the Blue Mountains and formed communities that defied British authority for over a century. Their success wasn't luck, it was strategy passed down through generations. The Maroons used terrain the way their ancestors had in West Africa. They built ambush paths, booby traps, and warning systems. They created secret trails and used animal horns to communicate over long distances. Their battles with the British were not random skirmishes, they were methodical campaigns. African war craft retooled for jungle warfare. In Haiti, the revolution that shook the world was led by former slaves who knew how to fight. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Henri Christophe, they were more than visionaries. They were tacticians. They coordinated campaigns using knowledge inherited from both African and European military models. But even more powerfully, they were protected, mentally and spiritually, by African cosmologies that fused with the fight. Vota ceremonies were not just spiritual, they were political. Before many uprisings, sacred rituals were performed, seeking favor and strength from the Loa. It was a spiritual military alliance. During the Bois Cayman ceremony, the spiritual birth of the Haitian Revolution, war and religion merged. The sacrifice, the possession, the oath sworn in darkness, it all laid the foundation for liberation. In Guyana and Suriname, other resistance fighters, known as the Bush Negroes or Maroons, waged extended campaigns against Dutch forces, retreating deep into the rainforest. Like their Caribbean counterparts, they maintained African battle techniques and spiritual traditions, often integrating camouflage, herbal poisons, and rainforest signaling. Women, too, were part of this warrior lineage. Nanny of the Maroons in Jamaica is now recognized as a national hero, but for generations her name was passed like a whisper. She was more than a freedom fighter. Oral tradition tells of her supernatural foresight, her unbreakable spirit, her command of guerrilla tactics. Many believe she was an Obia woman, drawing upon African mysticism to shield her people. Colonizers often dismissed African resistance as superstition, fetish rituals, savage customs. But they failed to understand the depth of integration between spirit and strategy. In African cosmology, there is no separation between the spiritual and the material. One cannot wage war without invoking the ancestors. Even today, the echoes remain. In martial arts forms like capoeira, brought from Angola and reborn in Brazil, or Kalinda stick fighting in Trinidad, or the secret Obia rites still whispered about in Jamaican hills, African warrior traditions survive. Not as folklore, but as embodied memory. The Caribbean was not pacified. It was never fully conquered. It was held down by violence, but it always pushed back, with fists, with spirits, with knowledge hidden in plain sight. Because the enslaved were not just victims. They were veterans. Sacred threads, African aesthetics in Caribbean clothing, symbols, and identity. To the untrained eye, Caribbean fashion might seem like a blend of tropical utility and post-colonial flair. Vibrant head wraps, flowing dresses, printed fabrics, and the occasional splash of gold. But to those who listen closely, each stitch tells a story. Clothing in the Caribbean is not mere fabric. It is history woven in thread, identity draped on skin, and Africa whispering through every pattern. The African aesthetic didn't vanish in the Middle Passage. It reemerged, adapted, encrypted, but unmistakably present. In West Africa, clothing has always been more than adornment. It's a language. Kent cloth speaks of lineage. Cowrie shells symbolize wealth, femininity, and spirit. Beads carry coded meanings of status, emotion, and protection. Colors, cuts, and cloth all communicate social messages without a word. These traditions crossed the ocean. In the Caribbean, enslaved Africans were often stripped of their native garments, forced to wear uniforms of European control, plain cotton shifts, rough linen trousers. But even under these constraints, they resisted. Head wraps, for instance, became symbols of both pride and protection. In places like Guadeloupe and Martinique, the Madras fabric, originally from India, adopted through colonial trade, was reshaped into elaborate turbans known as tignans. These were once mandated to mark the inferior status of African women, but evolved into powerful expressions of identity and flirtation. A single tilt of the wrap could signal if a woman was married, single, or available but not interested. In Jamaica, remnants of Akan and Ashanti weaving traditions are found in ceremonial dress worn during revival and Kumina rites. The layers, the vibrant contrasts, the use of red and white, all harken back to African spiritual codes. Clothing here became an interface between the physical and spiritual worlds. Rastafarian aesthetics also carry African echoes. The dreadlocks, so often reduced to mere fashion statements, are symbolic of the Lion of Judah, rebellion against Babylon, and the Nazarite vow. But deeper still, they trace back to the spiritual warriors of East Africa and to Indian sadhus through the global currents of colonial migration. Rastas often wear red, gold, green, and black, pan-African colors that unify spiritual identity with political resistance. Carnival dress, too, though heavily influenced by French and Spanish masquerade balls, has long been hijacked and re-energized by African design. Feathers, beads, glittering masks, these are not just theatrics. They are reinterpretations of ancestral rituals. In Nigeria and Benin, similar masks were worn to communicate with spirits. In Congo, elaborate costuming was a means of invoking power. In the Caribbean, these symbolic elements were fused with rebellion and joy. Costumes worn by the colonized to mock the colonizers, to reclaim the streets, to make the body a site of spectacle and sovereignty. Jewelry, too, tells hidden truths. In Barbados, gold hoop earrings were once used as family markers. In Trinidad, beads and bangles often correlate with spiritual beliefs. Many Caribbean women wear protective jewelry, blessed, anointed, or inherited, drawing upon obia, vodou, or ancestral blessing. Even tattoos and scarifications, largely erased through colonial shame, still flicker through cultural memory. The rise of Afrocentric body art across the diaspora today is not random. It's the return of a forgotten script. The power of African aesthetics in the Caribbean lies not only in beauty, but in symbolism. Clothing became camouflage for culture. Symbols became survival codes. What couldn't be spoken aloud was worn on the skin, around the neck, across the waist. Today, fashion movements like Afro-Caribbean fusion, natural hair revolutions, and diasporic streetwear aren't just trends. They're revolutions of remembrance. The runway becomes the return path. Cultural festivals become ceremonies. The ancestors walk again, stitched into the hems of modern life. In the Caribbean, style has always been strategy. Adornment is not vanity, it's heritage. Return to the source, reclaiming African identity in the modern Caribbean. The sound of drumming hasn't stopped. It's just changed venues, from the jungles of Jamaica to university halls in Kingston, from village ceremonies in Haiti to spoken word stages in Brooklyn, Brixton, and beyond. The African spirit, once forced into shadows, is stepping back into the Caribbean light. This chapter is not about the past, it's about the return. For centuries, African identity in the Caribbean was deliberately fractured. Education systems praised European civilization, while portraying Africa as a continent of darkness. Children were taught that progress meant forgetting, forgetting the gods, the languages, the heroes, and the stories that once shaped them. Blackness was something to tame. Africa was a place to escape, not embrace. But a transformation began, quietly at first, then louder, rising like a chorus. The cultural warriors of the 20th and 21st centuries sparked a reclamation. In the wake of independence movements across the Caribbean, intellectuals and artists began to peel back the colonial layers. Writers like M. Césaire in Martinique, George Lamming in Barbados, and Kamau Brathwaite in Jamaica redefined what it meant to be Caribbean and unapologetically African. Their words tore open the silence. Their poetry wasn't just beautiful, it was corrective surgery on the Caribbean soul. Pan-Africanism took hold as both political theory and emotional compass. Marcus Garvey's call to look to Africa was no longer distant prophecy, it was a roadmap. Festivals, music, education, even state policies began to shift. Africa was no longer backward. It was origin. Modern artists took up the mantle. In reggae, Capleton chants Africa into every verse. In dancehall, artists like Sizzla and Queen Ifrika speak the name of Ethiopia with reverence. In Trinidad, soca and chutney began referencing ancestral rhythm and pride. The diasporic loop tightened. Young people, too, began asking different questions. Not where did we lose ourselves, but where do we begin again? DNA ancestry tests, cultural tours to Ghana and Senegal, and social movements like hashtag back to Africa became more than hashtags. They became pilgrimage. Even institutions began to bend. Schools started teaching Garvey, Nani Dessalines. Museums unearthed artifacts once hidden in dusty archives. Cultural ministries embraced Afro-Caribbean heritage as a national asset, not an embarrassment. Still, the work is not finished. Colorism, internalized racism, and economic disparities continue to complicate identity. Many Caribbean people still wrestle with the question, what does it mean to be African in a place that once punished that identity? But something has shifted. The shame has begun to dissolve. Pride is no longer revolutionary, it's expected. You see it in hairstyles worn like crowns, in ancestral names being given to newborns, in murals of Haile Selassie and Queen Nzinga, in drumming workshops held on tourist beaches, in Rastafari communes and Voodoo temples and Yoruba revival gatherings. You see it in the music, in the food, in the dance, but most powerfully, in the eyes of a new generation who no longer whisper their history. They shout it, because the Caribbean is not a lost child of Africa. It is a returning prodigal, scarred, yes, but unbroken. Its people are not just survivors of trauma. They are curators of memory. And every act of remembrance is an act of liberation. Africa lives here, not as nostalgia, but as now,